You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. This past fall, the Department of Homeland Security released its 2024 Homeland Threat Assessment Report, predicting a range of national security issues that will be at the forefront in 2024. These included both foreign and domestic terrorism, specialized cyber threats, attacks on critical infrastructure, immigration and border security challenges, and the growth and regulation of AI, among others. Jumping ahead to just a couple of weeks ago, on May 29th, the Standing Committee on Law and National Security hosted a luncheon discussion featuring Jonathan Meyer, General Counsel for the Department of Homeland Security. Along with moderator Harvey Ryshikoff, Jonathan unpacked the key threats outlined in the report and discussed the DHS's ongoing efforts to address them. Today's episode features the audio from the luncheon program. Thanks for tuning in, and here's Harvey.
Good afternoon. If we could call the meeting to order. As you know, we're the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. We're having C-SPAN filming, so Stuart Baker, we know we'll try to make you a star later in the show. I'm very happy to have Jonathan here. As you can tell from his resume, he was confirmed by the Senate as the sixth General Counsel of the Department of Homeland Security. He's the Chief Legal Officer of the department. DHS now has approximately 3,500 attorneys who serve across it, so it makes him one of the largest law firms in the city. He's also the department's regulatory policy officer and is responsible for all regulatory and rulemaking activity. Prior to his return to DHS, he serves as DHS as a senior counsel and deputy general counsel from 2011 to 2016. He then returned. He was a partner at a law firm in D.C. where he counseled clients, as you would imagine, on federal, state government, as well as cybersecurity, high tech, homeland security, and congressional oversight. He's also served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at DOJ and as Special Deputy General Counsel at Amtrak, and as counsel to Senator, someone named Joseph Biden, on the Senate Judiciary Committee, ironically enough. Originally from Cincinnati, Jonathan spent part of his childhood in Jerusalem and speaks fluent Hebrew and French. So if anyone is supposed to question in French, Jonathan is more than happy to field it. He holds a bachelor's degree from Harvard College, where we discussed he was from social studies. And I love to see it when someone from social studies makes good in D.C. He has a JD from Columbia and an MPA from Princeton. He lives in Chevy Chase and has a lovely family and three children. Jonathan has expertise in a variety of areas. And I just want to note that clearly his career has been animated by public service, as opposed to us in the private sector. So he has really dedicated himself, I think, to the service of the Republic. And I want to commend you for that. But let me begin with an open sort of, we call a cottage cheese question, because it's bland, but it's good.
As long as it hasn't gone bad.
It hasn't gone bad. It's still fresh, still fresh. What do you find is the most significant legal challenges you're currently facing, particularly in the areas of, let's say, cybersecurity and the obvious one, which is, I think, immigration? How would you characterize those, Jonathan?
So first of all, Harvey, thank you. And thank you to Jason and to the committee for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here, and it's always fun to be around so many smart legal minds, especially legal minds so knowledgeable in the areas where we practice. And thank you for that kind introduction, Harvey. In terms of most challenging legal questions we face, I mean, there are so many, I don't know that I can claim any one is most challenging, but you know, some of the things, let me put it this way, that are on my mind, I'll start with immigration and then we can talk about cybersecurity. On immigration, I think there's a number of issues that are coming to the forefront right now. One is the issue of federalism and preemption, which is coming up over and over again as states try to enact laws that would enforce federal immigration law. And as you know, those are now in the courts. That is an important issue. I think another issue that is not purely a legal issue, but affects the legal issues is the political stalemate on immigration, because As we've seen, there is only so much that can be done through executive action and through legal action without legislation. Unfortunately, significant immigration reform legislation is not at the moment moving. So it becomes a challenge for us to really see what we can do to try to address issues of migration and immigration without that assistance. In terms of cybersecurity, but the facet of cybersecurity that makes it a challenge both legally and in the non-legal arena is the ever-changing nature of it. It is a fast-moving field because it is driven by innovation and technology. And so the law has to try to keep up with it, which can always be a challenge. It's a challenge that we try to be up to, but it's also what makes it fascinating. But it is, you know, almost inherently an ever-changing field. It's also still a relatively new field, cybersecurity, and therefore cybersecurity law. So the law is still nascent and developing. That's part of what makes it fun, because you can be involved in the development of this new body of law. It's not that new anymore. It's, you know, cybersecurity law has really been active, I'd say, I don't know, Stuart could probably tell us better, but probably about, I'd say 20 years, which, you know, when you're talking about common law that's been around for hundreds of years is pretty new. And so there's a lot still to be figured out, I think. And that's a challenge. As I say, in that sense, it's kind of a fun challenge, but it's a challenge.
Right. We can't open our Blackstone to get a sense of what the right rule is.
Yeah, right. There's no Prosser on cybersecurity.
There's no Prosser yet. But raising that issue to follow up on it, so as you know, recently the FBI has had something called Rule 41, which allows them to go onto networks and remove bad malware, which has been a little bit controversial. And so an interesting question is, how do you understand the relationship between the Bureau and DHS and CISA as being one of the major organs that we have that you sort of oversee? And the part B of that question is, the goal of this talk is to have you remain promotable. So, but is there any other legislative issues or things, if we gave you a magic wand and we could end the stalemate on the Hill, that you would like to see enacted or would give the DHS more power that you think would be important?
The relationship between FBI and CISA on cybersecurity can be confusing. And I speak from experience in private practice when I had clients facing cybersecurity issues. One of the first questions always was, do we go to the FBI first? Do we go to CISA? One, the other, both. It can be confusing. But I think as a general matter, look, FBI's focus is on investigation and enforcement. CISA's focus is, first of all, one part of its focus is it's on government networks. But not just that. It's because it focuses on critical infrastructure and the like. And also, its focus is on assistance to a great extent, offering resources to the private sector, to critical infrastructure sectors and others. And so to help them harden, to help them figure out what is happening, in addition, to get their assistance in learning and figuring out what more we, the government, can be doing to prevent vulnerabilities, to prevent cybercrime, to prevent malicious foreign actors from taking those malicious foreign acts. So that is how I would describe the relationship between the two. But they interact, obviously, a lot. That's important. I think as to the Rule 41 issue, I think therefore it is less of an issue for CISA, because where they are most active in terms of themselves getting involved in networks is primarily on government networks, so it's less of an issue. With regards to legislation, look, I mean, obviously, I will not make any news and will remain promotable by saying it would have been and would be great if the bipartisan border security bill could pass. As I say, I'm not going to excite anyone with that statement, but it is so true. And if not that, something like it, because there is a great need. Immigration system, as anyone in the field will tell you, is broken. There is need for a fix, and Congress is best positioned to do that. In terms of other things, look, you know, another thing that unfortunately drew a lot of my time over the past year and a half on the Hill, but was not really legislation, was the whole impeachment thing, which was very unfortunate, and we can get into that if you like. But I think Congress has took a wrong turn on that, and I hope there will not be more of that coming down the pike. But obviously, there's a lot of other things that can be done. There's a lot of work going on with AI now, and I know the Hill is interested, everyone's interested. There is work to be done by all sides on that. Talk about developing areas, that's even much more so than mm-hmm. cyber is. So there's plenty to do.
Well, why you wear two hats on the AI, because you're running one of the largest law firms in the country. And as you know, there are a lot of senior managers in law firms are exploring AI and the impact it may have on associates in being able to reduce the workload. And at the same token, we have a whole question of AI and how we understand the evolution of privacy. So you wear both hats. You have a policy hat and you also have a managerial hat. So how are you sort of exploring that in your policy hat and your managerial hat? Are we going to reduce the number of lawyers at DHS by 30 or 25% if we are able to use AI the way many of the companies are promising to senior partners and law firms that that's going to be the future?
I don't see the number of attorneys at DHS going down anytime soon for that reason or any other. In fact, we're now, you said 3,500, we're now up to close to 4,000 attorneys at DHS.
But we love that here at the ABA.
So. Yes, no, and it's and doing incredibly important work. And I will tell you, at least from my experience, everyone is very busy.
Yeah.
But you're right. Look, I look at AI both as a manager of a legal office and then also the larger departmental issues, which are much broader and deeper. From the OGC standpoint, we've been spending a lot of time thinking about it. I've had a number of conversations with my chief of staff and others, and we are in the process of developing a policy for our lawyers on AI. There's no question it can be an extremely valuable tool. There's also no question it can be a very dangerous crutch, as has been demonstrated with, you know, the silly stories about lawyers looking like cats and lawyers submitting briefs written by AI that turned out to cite false cases. So it is not a substitute for the attorney doing the legal thinking, the legal work. But just as, you know, we were talking about Prosser and Blackstone, right? When I was in law school, and I'm sure it was true for many of us here, you went and looked up cases in a book. And you shepherdized by going to the shepherd's books. Right? And then along came Lexis and Westlaw and other tools that made us much more efficient, much more accurate, much better at what we do. I think we have to view, for lawyers, we have to view AI as a tool like that, perhaps likely much more powerful than those things, but a tool, not a substitute. Now, with regard to the department, it's a much broader issue because now you're talking about the threats that can come from the use of AI by our adversaries, the use AI can be put to in defending the homeland, the use of AI in misinformation and malinformation and disinformation, but again, the use of AI in collecting intelligence. The possibilities are manifold, and we are spending across the government a lot of time thinking through all of that now. As many of you know, the president put out an executive order on artificial intelligence, I believe it was in October. That called for a lot of follow-up work, which is happening now across the interagency, across the government, including in particular at DHS. DHS appears a lot in that executive order. One of the things that the EO called for is the setting up of what's called the AISSB, the Artificial Intelligence Safety and Security Board, which is a board that the secretary has stood up of really dignitaries in the field to advise the department and the government on the use of AI. And there's any number of other issues we are looking at, including privacy and civil liberties issues. Yeah. So our chief privacy officer, Mason Clutter, and our COCL officer, Shobha Sivaprasad, and others are looking at. And it includes absolutely the lawyers, because there's a lot of legal issues it raises too.
So you touched on another non-controversial issue, which is elections. And as you know, the 2020, the 2024 security of elections, that remit also falls under your jurisdiction. And what are your thoughts about how the department is positioning itself for the upcoming election to ensure that we have an election with integrity and something that will bestow legitimacy on the next president of the United States?
Yeah, so absolutely, that is something that the department is spending a ton of time on. A number of parts of the department, the secretary first and foremost, but also again CISA, yeah, through its focus on infrastructure. There is, again, a lot to do, whether it be attempts by foreign actors to mess with the election or domestically, and whether it be, you know, the more mechanical, if you will, issue of hardening election voting systems against cyber attack, making sure that technology is accurate and that sort of thing, or the what I'll refer to as the softer sorts of threats of foreign actors trying inappropriately to influence the election through the use of mal disinformation, sometimes powered by AI, sometimes by through other means. There's a lot that is going on. We are constantly on the lookout. I should say, in addition to CISA, INA, Intelligence and Analysis Directorate, is very focused on these issues as well. So whereas, you know, certainly 8-12 years ago, I think the issue caught a lot of people by surprise, that's certainly not going to happen this time around. We are very focused on it with the upcoming election, and doing everything that we can within our authority to make sure that the election will be safe, secure, and most importantly, as a result of that, trustworthy.
One of the questions which you sort of touched is our famous Section 230 and social media. Do you see the department taking positions with other parts of the government on that issue and filing briefs? Or is that going to be left to the Department of Justice to put forward? Or do you guys participate in what you would like to see as part of a new legal rule or legal approach?
We and the Secretary and people like our Undersecretary for Policy, Rob Silvers, have spent a lot of time engaging with the technology companies and social media and talking about the best ways to engage with them. And we, you know, there is already some litigation relating to that work, which is before the Supreme Court, so I won't go into the details of that. But again, it falls into the larger issue of information. You know, a lot of what we do as the lawyers is to make sure we are advising the department in a way that allows us to correct inaccurate information, to spot disinformation, malinformation, without having a heavy hand and without impinging on any First Amendment rights and the like. So we spend a lot of time on that. I think we've done a pretty good job. As I say, I need to be a little careful because this is being litigated.
Yeah, I'll move on. So the other aspect, the other area in the world that's moved very aggressively in this space is, of course, the Europeans. And their GDPR legislation is covering a lot of the waterfront. What is your sense of how you see the department positioned in those debates? And what would be the policy approach you're taking where you run up against those European pieces of legislation and jurisdiction?
So when I was in private practice, I spent a lot of time advising clients on GDPR and other privacy laws that are out there, various state laws and the like. You know, in my world, it does not come up on a daily basis, which is not to say that lawyers at DHS aren't dealing with it, but in terms of what comes up to me. But, you know, where DHS plays a role is in some of the agreements that we have with foreign countries. And there we have to negotiate with foreign countries who, and if they're European, they are under GDPR. And it is a, and by the way, this was happening before GDPR too, when I was at the department during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. I was involved in advising on a number of negotiations with other countries about exchanges of information. And it's, so we have to take that all into account. We are under an obligation, of course, to abide by American laws of privacy and security. But where we're dealing with a foreign country, they may demand that we abide with at least some of their laws. But, and this is where it becomes important, in particular for DHS, is when we're talking about things like security of air travel and shipping and the like. And so we engage in constant conversations and negotiations with our partners about how we will exchange information. And sometimes it's going the other way, too, because the Europeans want information from us about people who may be traveling who could pose a danger. So it all plays into that calculus. But we've got incredibly skilled policy folks and lawyers who work through that thicket and generally come out with good outcomes.
Yes, I don't think people generally know you also have the Coast Guard under DHS.
Yes. Yeah, people often forget that. It is a huge part of DHS, a tremendous part of DHS. And yeah, it's often forgotten, even when I'm dealing with other parts of within our own government, they will forget that one of the military services is actually part of DHS. It's not part of DOD. And we have to remind them and make sure that the Coast Guard gets included in conversations. But they're very involved in a lot of work, including some of the migration work we do. So it's great that they are a part of the department. And I know some of you worked at DHS. It is always such a pleasure to work with the Coast Guard attorneys. They are just incredibly smart people, devoted to the mission, always willing to talk and happy to tell you about what they're doing at the Coast Guard. So it really is one of the fun parts of it.
Well, we're very excited because we're an affiliate of the committee, Admiral Kevin Lunday, mm-hmm. who actually is a lawyer, a JAG officer, right. has just been named as the Deputy Commandant. So we like to see lawyers in these high positions because it helps kind of smooth the process.
And the current Deputy Commandant, outgoing, is also a lawyer, Steve Poulin.
Yeah.
And I first met him when he was the chief lawyer at the Coast Guard when I was at the department in the Obama administration. So, it's always great to have lawyers in non-legal positions.
Yes. So I'm going to have one more question, and then I'll open it up to the audience. But you mentioned shepherdizing, and there's some young lawyers over here who actually think you're speaking Greek using that term. So one of the interesting issues, what advice would you give, given where you sit now, to young lawyers? What courses or things that you would recommend that would help them prepare for a career in public service at this point where you sit that you'd like to see them come out of law school with?
So there are a few pieces of advice I give to young lawyers when I talk to them, ones who want to go into government. The first is don't lose sight of that goal. If that's really what you want to do, don't lose sight of that goal, because it's quite common, and it was true with me. I came out of law school, I went to a big law firm. I was at Davis Polk in New York. I was making good money. And then was at Wilmer here in DC. And I saw some of my colleagues who started out wanting to go into public service, never really go. And the reason was because they got used to the money. And it became too financially difficult to make that move. So my first piece of advice is, it's fine to start out in private practice. Don't let yourself get used to the money. Don't budget yourself like you're going to be at that firm forever, or you will be at that firm forever, or one like it, because government does not pay as much. You can get by fine on government. I've been in government, I think, most of my career at this point. But that's the first thing. The second thing is, have goals, but be flexible. I was just talking to one of the DHS people who's here today on our way over and telling her, and I tell people this all the time, you know, when I came out of law school, I was not planning to be a Homeland Security lawyer, perhaps in part because Homeland Security didn't exist as a field, but I wasn't even planning to be a national security lawyer. I knew I wanted to be in government, and I really sort of ended up at DHS and in the field that I'm in almost by accident because an opportunity came along and I took it. But if I had been too inflexible in what I wanted to do, that wouldn't have happened. So the great thing about being an attorney in Washington is the ability, as so many of us have done, as Jason and Stuart and Paul have done, is to go back and forth between the private sector and the government. And you should take full advantage of that opportunity. It's really a wonderful way to have a career, and you should be open to unexpected opportunities. I should say, you know, you said I worked for Joe Biden on the Senate Judiciary Committee. That happened by chance, too. That happened because someone I was working with at DOJ was offered an opportunity to be a detailee to Joe Biden's staff and decided she didn't want to do it because she had young kids and didn't feel like she could devote the time, and came to me and said, hey, this thing was offered to me. I can't do it. Are you interested? Right? So if not for that, who knows where I'd be today. So it's just so much luck happens, which is not to say that everything happens by luck, but everything, a lot happens by luck, and you need to be open to the luck and to the opportunities that come along and be flexible.
Yes, there's a lot of serendipity.
So much.
That sort of explains our careers. Yeah. Any questions that you'd have for the general counsel? Sir, identify who you are and then say the question.
My name is Zane Protas. I'm a legal intern with the DHS OGC HQ. I work directly
with him. That's where I didn't
play. He didn't. So I know it's an ongoing case, and you might not be able to give the most feedback on it, but with the relentless decision expected to come out soon, the sort of expectation is that agency regulations will be given less deference when challenged in court in the future. Do you think that will make it difficult for the DHS to, I guess, put out effective regulations?
I think it will be difficult for any regulating agency. We have lived in a world of deference to agency regulations for so long. And look, I don't think it would be terrible in theory for there to be less deference to agencies on regulations if, as the system is presumably supposed to work, Congress were able to be more active and to give that guidance. The problem is that Congress is 535 people trying to legislate for a government, for a country of over 300 million people, and cannot get to every small issue. And so then you have a real vacuum in terms of what agencies can do. And I think that is the problem. And then you have the courts having to weigh in every time and look at it without deference. It becomes more chaotic. There is less legal certainty for anyone who is affected by the regulation. So I think it is a problem. As I say, I don't, as a personal opinion, think there should or should not be deference. The problem is in the real world of working it out, that I think it will create a lot of difficulties if we can't have that.
Any more cottage cheese questions that are out in the audience that you may want to ask? Stuart.
So I
may identify you are. Some people don't know you.
I'm Stuart Baker, and I was head of policy and the source of many of the legal problems that General Counsel
had. I'm so glad you're on my client's
list. Yes. Yes. So many of us feel that way. Yes.
I once got an opinion back from the General Counsel's office, and I said, well, this is very thoughtful, but it's not exactly heroic. We needed heroic lawyers in my view. This is a question you can answer or not. There must be, you're one of the few people who's had to look at the law and the way in which impeachments have been handled over years. There's got to be something that you thought was remarkably humorous about some aspect of impeachment. So I would ask, what's the lighter side of impeachment?
Yeah, it's funny. We did have a lot of laughs over the course of the process. I'm trying to remember now what was particularly funny. I'm drawing a blank.
Let me help you so that you move on. Is there anything about the impeachment process that you'd like to see reformed? When we were growing up, it never happened. And now we've had a series of impeachments, even going down to a secretary as opposed to a president. And that's been sort of unusual. Now, it's in the Constitution, It's clearly a process, it's very political. But is there anything you, on reflection being in the middle of it, what you would like to see sort of done that would be a constitutional reform that, or a statutory reform?
Well, I mean, look, you're exactly right that it has become too common. Another way to put it, Harvey, is that, because I got to do all this research, there have been, we did a calculation, there have been something like over 800 people who have served as members of a president's cabinet in the history of the United States. Until this year, not a single one had had an impeachment taken up by the Senate. Now, some of you may think, oh, that's not right. I read something. There was some guy named William Belknap. Yes, Secretary of War William Belknap in 1876 was impeached. But A, by the time he was impeached, he had resigned. And B, even that was not taken up by the Senate. But perhaps most importantly, C, the guy had demonstrably been taking bribes and kickbacks and enriching himself at the expense of the public fisc. None of which is the case with the guy who was impeached this year. And more importantly, there really, throughout the entire process, there was no serious, I would argue, not even, I don't even have to word, put in the word serious, there was no implication of any personal misconduct. And that's what impeachment's supposed to be about. And it's not really even a point of debate. If you look at the constitutional debates, the framers actually discussed whether, quote unquote, maladministration should be impeachable. And they explicitly said, I think it was James Madison who said, no, if you do that, it will make everyone serving at the pleasure of the Senate, which is not what we have in this republic. We do not have votes of no confidence. So it's funny in the sense of, like, I'm laughing because I'm not crying. But it has gone, this, what happened this year took it in the direction of being, as you say, yes, it's always been purely political in the sense of, as I think it was, I forget who it was who said that now, one of you probably knows, but someone said, you know, what's impeachable is whatever gains 2/3 of the Senate, right? It has always depended on votes, but like so much, and you're seeing this more broadly in our political society today, that there were all, and we didn't realize it. For most of my life, we didn't realize it. There were all these rules that it turned out were really unwritten rules that are now being ignored because they're not written. And this was one of them, that you don't impeach over a disagreement about policy. And I would argue it's even more than, I mean, it is written, as I said. It's in the constitutional history of the United States. But because the rule is whatever gets the votes, it doesn't really, it's not treated as a rule, even though it should be. So I think, yeah, my best description of it is it is, unfortunately, it exemplifies a broader phenomenon we're seeing in this country, which is an abandonment of a lot of a political culture, a lot of unwritten rules that were abided by both sides for centuries. And that is a very, very disturbing development in my mind.
Angus in the back, why don't you identify yourself?
Thank you for speaking. My name is Angus. I'm an intern at the ABA. I wondered, what do you want your legacy to be when you leave DHS? How do you want to be remembered?
Thank you, Angus. That's a great question. And because it gives me an opportunity to talk about one thing I haven't talked about, which is the people at DHS and the people at OGC. And what I'd like to be remembered for, well, let me back up before I get to that direct answer and say this. You know, I often tell people I have a really easy job because the most important thing I did was walking in the door on October 6, 2021, after I got confirmed. And I say that because the last number of years have been a very difficult period set aside for the country, for the department, and for OGC. The prior Senate-confirmed general counsel had been fired. It had been, OGC had been without a Senate-confirmed general counsel for, David Palmer, the chief of staff, who many of you know, could tell you the exact number of days, of something like 800 days. And I think there was a lot of trepidation. And I think, you can ask them, but I think a lot of the lawyers at DHS, the career attorneys, all breathed a sigh of relief when they learned I was going to be the general counsel. Not because of anything in particular about me, but it was because it was someone they knew who they had worked with and who was serious about the mission. And I could have had two heads and they would have breathed a sigh of relief. And one of my real priorities, all joking aside, in the office has been to restore an ethic of support for our lawyers, of serious lawyering, of respect for the rule of law, and of really honoring the work that we do. And I hope whenever I leave that will be what people will remember me for more than anything. Because it's, and most of you know this, so many of you have connections, and many of you here are DHS attorneys, he said, looking at Ian Brazier. It's a great group of attorneys. It really is. You know, the secretary, whenever he talks about OGC, he says, he doesn't say the part about us being the largest law firm in the United States, he says we're the best law firm in the United States. And it's just an incredibly talented group of devoted, dedicated public servants. And really, a lot of my job is just to stay out of their way and or to make sure that any barriers are cleared for them to do their work. And yes, I hope that will be my legacy, if nothing else, that I was able to empower our attorneys and bring a sense of order and honor and respect for the practice of law at DHS.
So first, let me thank Jason for bringing this lovely guest to our group. And you're now part of the family. So let me end with thanking Jason, our intern who asked that lovely question, Angus and Holly, as always, for putting this together. And I think you remain promotable, and I think you've made a lot of new friends with how charming and elegant you've been and thoughtful in the discussions. So join me in please thanking.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.